This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
This week, if it feels like Elon and Tesla all the time, well, it kind
of
is.
We got more Elon for you. The cover story of the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, as our team questions some of his tactics to be, among other things, well, funny. We talked about that yesterday. Another story that's got an Elon angle happens to be the Bloomberg Big Take today. It's all about another Elon property. We're talking Twitter and that company's most faithful supporter of Elon.
That's right. With her and Kurt Wagner's story, let's get to Bloomberg News technology reporter Davy Alba. She is with us in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. So great to have you here with us. We've talked so much about Elon and Tesla this week, but
I'm sure
Twitter is always on our mind as well when it comes to Elon. And that's what you write about. And you write about specifically Ella Irwin. Who is she?
So Ella Irwin is the new head of trust and safety at Twitter. She actually started at the company in 2022, like midway through the year. So she's a relatively new.
She's a newbie.
Yeah exactly. She stepped in after the former head of trust and safety, Yoel Roth, left the company. And she's been kind of Elon's chief executor of his whims, as we say in the story, and has just kind of been breaking all sorts of norms in how content policy is usually done on Twitter.
What I find so interesting about this is she didn't come to Twitter with Elon Musk. She was there.
No, yeah, that's
and,
right.
And, you know, a lot of people in Elon Musk's inner circle who have been close to him for years are just that. They've been close to him for years.
Exactly.
I mean, he brought in engineers from SpaceX, for example, to do some work at Twitter or Tesla or both companies. Like, he brings people around with him,
exactly.
Right?
There's,
so what has she done in recent months that brings you to this conclusion?
Yeah, well, so she has sort of proven herself to be an Elon loyalist in the time that she's been back at the company. There's all sorts of internal documentation that we have that shows that when Elon sort of wants to ban or suspend this or that account, the notes that accompany the decision, it says at the direction of Ella or at the direction of Elon. So, you know, even though she is someone who predated Elon, she joined at the company as the acquisition of Twitter was looming. And, you know, ever since has sort of proven herself to be someone who's fully in his camp.
Are employees at Twitter in her camp?
So that's part of our story. They are, you know, quite at odds with her, I would say. The employees we talked to, more than a dozen current and former trust and safety employees at Twitter, say that she has run the group in a very unconventional way. Twitter policy has been built up over the past decade or so, and so have other social media content policy rules. What Ella Irwin is doing at the company is very antithetical to this sort of idea that you have to make these spaces very palatable to most people. Of course, no harassment, no hate speech, that kind of thing. Usually there are content policy rules that you can point to for justification for certain actions that you take on the platform. And she's not, you know, sort of pointing to these justifications anymore. It's all at Elon's discretion.
And look, you know, people who support what Elon's doing at Twitter say he owns the company. He can kind of do whatever he wants there.
Yeah, that's right.
There was this moment in mid-December that I remember. I mean, I remember where I was when I saw these tweets where everybody kind of felt like Twitter was melting down.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Sweeney, the kid who follows Elon, who followed for years Elon Musk's and other celebrities' planes on the platform, somebody who Elon Musk said previously he wouldn't ban, that would show his commitment to free speech, banned him. And then all these journalists started getting banned from prominent news organizations. Take us through what happened then, because this was kind of a key part of her role at Twitter.
Yeah, so she had just stepped back in at the company then. And again, in our reporting, it shows that when Elon Jet, the account run by Jack Sweeney, when Elon sort of decided that this was something that risked his personal safety, then it was banned, even though he said he wouldn't have done, he wouldn't do that. And the journalists, I think, you know, that was totally a turning point, as you say, because, you know, the journalists covered Twitter and Musk, and because they were sort of putting out posts that were about Elon Jet, that was the justification for banning them. And I think, you know, there are a couple of layers to this story. The first is, you know, the content policy rules have been drawn up for a reason. It's good for business. Advertisers don't want to have their ads against hate speech and like really vile content, right? And so,
and I would say a lot of users, we included,
absolutely
don't want to be necessarily on a platform
that exposes you to toxic
kind of monitoring.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the other layer, I think, here, which goes back to sort of the suspension of the journalists, is that this is already becoming a platform where there isn't clear oversight over the decisions made. And, you know, these journalists that were banned are very high profile and have huge audiences. But if Elon is sort of banning people willy-nilly, and we don't hear about them, like what about activists around the world,
right?
You know, well, human rights advocates, that kind of thing.
Well, let's get into that. I mean, Davey, I think at this point what we're trying to figure out, because now Twitter's a privately held company,
yep,
right? And so it doesn't feel like there's the public disclosure that maybe we had with the company before that might not be so forthcoming. And so we're trying to get a handle on, is there basically, like when there was at Google, an adult in the room, right? Is there an adult in the room at Twitter? And is she it?
Well, I would say that, you know, Elon is Twitter at this point. So if you consider Elon the adult in the room, then sure. But
so Ella, I mean, you know, I guess you always want for a leader to surround himself with smart people, but also people who will be like, well, wait a minute.
Yeah. Who disagree.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah, of course.
And so is she it?
I wouldn't say so, just because she so far has executed every directive that he has made on the platform.
And you guys have talked to people that know her, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we talked to some people who used to work with her at Amazon and Twilio. You know, they see her as a very effective operator and product manager, but she hasn't had the kind of deep experience in trust and safety that, you know, there's been a whole field that's grown up around this stuff, again, over the past decade or so. And in that situation, you know, she seems, you know, at least our sources say, unable to push back on Elon. Hmm.
So taking a step back and thinking about, you've been covering Twitter for quite a while, the experience of people on the platform and what's changed. I have my own theories and my own, based on my own experiences.
Yeah.
Carol and I have been like, you know, sucked into the algorithmic feed and like
trying
to get away from that.
It's been an interesting time.
What are your takeaways? What have you seen?
You know, it's hard to say beyond anecdotal. I mean, we're going to do some reporting on this, of course. There's data-based reporting that we can do on sort of the rise in hate speech and sort of slurs and that kind of thing. And we have reported on that sort of thing. Anecdotally, my experience has been, you know, like sort of on and off, like I've seen it become more glitchy. I don't know if you guys have
Absolutely.
Had that experience.
Yeah. Especially in the app.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And there are all sorts of weird features that are cropping up that kind of come out of nowhere, like the views count and the For You feed, that, you know, some users are sort of like, well, we never asked for this, you know. And I think as Elon decides to exercise control over what we see on Twitter and what sorts of things can be on Twitter, he's reinstated a lot of folks who have been banned for hate speech and spreading misinformation about the coronavirus and all of these things. That affects the health of the platform on the whole.
Hey, Davey, just in 15 seconds, if Ella speaks, should we assume that's Elon speaking?
I think she needs to be very careful about what she says. It has to be Elon approved. So it could be her, but it's Elon approved.
All right. Good to know. Really some good great answer. Insight, right, into Twitter. Davey Alba, thank you so much. Bloomberg News technology reporter. Check out her stories by she and Kurt Wagner. It is on the Bloomberg Terminal. She's joining us here in our Interactive Broker studio.
Yeah, check it out. It's the Big Take today. It's at Bloomberg.com/Big Take. And of course, as Carol mentioned, always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
So dying to do this story. It was a most read when it hit the Bloomberg this week. By the way, it is still is for the week overall. It's in the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, which, as you know, out on newsstands, online at Bloomberg.com and on the Bloomberg. We just want to get right to it because the story is how to be 18 years old again for only $2 million a year.
Here to introduce us to Brian Johnson and his mission, we've got Ashley Vance. He's Bloomberg Business Week features writer, also the author of Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future. So Ashley, answer that question for us. Who is Brian Johnson? I think a lot of people use a product that he was instrumental in bringing to market quite frequently. Who is this guy?
Yeah, you know, he's a software entrepreneur, loosely. That's how he started. There's a company called Braintree, which is not like a household name, but people use it all the time. And it's also acquired Venmo, which people probably do know. So it was helps you know, process mobile payments on the internet and process credit cards. And Brian ran that company in his 30s and sold it to PayPal a few years ago for $800 million. And that's kind of how he made his fortune.
All right, and now he wants to be young again or so. Jill Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, also in studio with us.
Okay, so I can be 18 again if I have a team of 30 doctors and a $2 million a year budget. What do I get for that treatment, Ashley?
A lot of work.
Sound exhausting, actually.
It looks exhausting. Silicon Valley and I guess other people have been kind of obsessed with longevity and reversing aging for a long time. We've all heard these stories. Brian's kind of taken it to the next level. So he's got all these doctors, his theories, he's trying to add some metrics and measurements and proof to this whole field. And so what all these people do is literally test every part of his body with as many research grade instruments as they can. So we're talking MRIs, ultrasounds, blood tests, stool samples, everything. And then, he does a series of therapies, stuff that begins at just like eating well and exercising and goes up to laser treatments on his skin and things like that to try and correct issues and give him the body of a much younger person. Wait,
there's eating well, as we know it. But then there's also what Brian Johnson does, which is like,
to the extreme.
You tried it. You tried it, Ashley.
Yeah, how'd that go?
What is this concoction that he puts in a blender?
Yeah, so every day Brian eats exactly 1,977 calories, and like he likes to say that each calorie has to fight for its life in his diet. And I went to his house, his kind of mansion in Venice, California, and I got to see what he has for his daily diet. Some of it is okay. There's this thing that he calls nutty pudding, and it's basically berries and some yogurt type stuff, and that's good. But then, the heart of what he eats is this kind of vegetable sludge, which starts out at cauliflower and broccoli and lentils and things that I actually like, but when you mush them all together,
separate,
it almost had just like no taste. It tasted like dirt, and Brian swears it's delicious, but I had trouble getting it all down.
Okay, can you talk to us about meeting him at the front door?
Yeah, well, so I've been following Brian for years, and so I know exactly what he looks like and all that. And we were setting up for this dinner, and he sent me a text message while I was waiting in my car for him to arrive, and he said, "I might look a little different this time. I just had some fat injected into my face, and I had an allergic reaction." And then when he finally did appear, his face was swollen about three times its normal size, but he's got this glowing, very beautiful, pale skin. And so, in the story, I say he looked like a giant porcelain doll, and he really did.
And were you tempted to join in that experiment?
Not on that one. That one looked a little outside of my comfort zone, But Brian, to his credit, man, he takes all this stuff in stride. He just kind of laughed about it. His son came in and he just kind of had a giggle like he's seen all this stuff before. And so Brian just does it and moves on.
Okay, so are there takeaways for us mere mortals who don't actually want to rewind the clock this obsessively but maybe steal a couple things from his wisdom? Like what have you adopted from Brian's routine that I might want to consider?
Not as much as I should. You would think this would be like a revelation.
Not the sludge? Come on.
No, I wish I could say it was. I mean, if anyone's curious, so there's a couple things I took away. If anyone's curious, they can go to, if they search Project Blueprint, that's what this is called, and Brian Johnson, he's got everything listed on this website that he eats, that he puts on his face, all of that. And so you could kind of pick and choose where you want to get into this thing. I would say, in the big picture, my takeaway is that, there really are people who are trying to move this field to a better place. I mean, the whole point of this is like we hear about fad diets, you hear about the TB12 method, and like no one knows if any of this stuff works. And so, he's publishing everything out in the open, all his data. He's one of many people who are trying to advance this field and be open about what's going on.
Not sure I'm ready to try the nutty pudding. Having said that, though,
that sounds good.
Seriously, folks, in terms of what's going on inside his body, though, some of his doctors are excited, right?
Yeah. I mean, some of this sounds kind of a little nuts at first blush, but then you look at his metrics, they're pretty good. You know, I mean, first of all, the guy is like, I mean, if you look at him, he is ripped, like professional athlete and beyond ripped. And, you know, like his resting heart rate is like 43. He's got the lung capacity of an 18-year-old. He's got the gum inflammation of a 17-year-old. And so, you know,
my doctor never checks that out on me.
Well, see, that's the point here. But yeah, no, I mean, there's parts of him that are just clearly incredibly healthy. And according to this data, you know, he really has sort of reversed the age and the overall health of a lot of his innards.
I think a lot of people might want to live longer so they can spend more time doing things that they love, so they can spend more time with their families, so they can, you know, have a longer life. But there's this conundrum in reading your story, Ashley, just in the last 30 seconds that we have, is this is so exhausting and this is so all-encompassing that it seems like to me he doesn't have time to do those other things.
Well, yeah, this is the one trick. I mean, like I say, I've known him for a while and we always debate this. I'm like, look, man, one of my favorite things on earth is to go have a really nice late dinner with a bunch of friends, a bit of wine, you know, and he's just not, that's not even an option for him. And, you know, what he's doing is a full commitment. I think he would argue that he's at the forefront of this. He's a pioneer. The stuff's going to get cheaper and easier to use over time.
Is he happy, though?
He's beyond happy. I mean, this is sort of like a religious calling for him, you know.
Well, next up, gene therapies, as you write about, some more experimental procedures. So
put it right in the face.
We look forward to seeing what's next for Brian Johnson, and I'm sure it'll be written by Ashley Vance. Ashley of Bloomberg Business Week, along with Jill Weber. Check out the new issue of the magazine.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, don't look now, but Bitcoin is up, what, 41% this year?
I had to triple check this.
You thought, like, wait, did I not have the right days?
What is going on?
Well, we're not just talking about the prices of digital assets. Bloomberg News reporting earlier that the crypto firm Custodio Bank's application to become a member of the Federal Reserve has been denied. There's a lot going on in the crypto universe, setting up a roadblock in the company's bid to get coveted access to the central bank's payment system. So, yeah, there's a lot going on in this world, as always.
And we got a weekly crypto segment. Very pleased to have back with us Kathy Kraninger, VP of Regulatory Affairs at Solidus Labs. She's former director of the U.S. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, also known as the CFPB, during the Trump administration. Solidus Labs monitors risk for crypto assets. Kathy joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Kathy, how are you?
I'm doing really well. Great to be back with you, Carol and Tim.
It's good to have you back with us. Okay, so I don't want to start with the price of Bitcoin. I want to talk about the regulatory environment. I don't think any of us can, I mean, unless you can explain the price.
Yeah,
unless you can explain what's been going on. But I want to talk regulation with you because in the wake of, you know, Three Arrows in the earlier part of 2022, the hedge fund that just blew up, as well as the decline of FTX, the demise of FTX, and all the contagion that we've seen of late with Genesis, Gemini, Digital Currency Group, and you know, even the regulatory issue that Carol mentioned earlier today, there's a big question that faces kind of the future of the environment. I'm wondering how you're looking at things at Solidus Labs. Like, are you concerned at all?
Well, I can tell you that we are still bullish about the possibility and opportunity that blockchain technology and tokenization can bring to the future of finance. But it's an uphill battle. I mean, and it's completely understandable when you hear the news, you hear from investors who were harmed and defrauded, frankly, and you didn't quite mention FTX, Tim, in that, but maybe people are sick of hearing about all of that really pretty awful news there. So the industry has a ton of work to do to regain credibility. And frankly, to take out, really note those that are really not acting the way they should in terms of taking care of their investors and providing proper disclosures, providing proper surveillance.
But I think the hard part with this, Kathy, was that for a lot of people, you know, like a venture capital firm out of Silicon Valley said they did their due diligence. For a lot of people, FTX, for example, was doing the right thing. They were sort of held up as, you know, and SBF was really like the face of a crypto industry that wanted to be regulated.
Well, that is the challenge that always comes in these types of situations where there is, greed and money and people really going the wrong direction. You really lose trust. It's a breach of trust. There was a lot of engagement with regulators across the globe, lawmakers across the globe. And as I said, a big hole to really dig ourselves out of. But we have a new Congress, and there are a lot of legislators who are engaged in these topics and interested in them. And you see that at the beginning of the year here with a number of people staking out their positions or reasserting them. Senator Warren did an event this week on crypto. We also have Chairman McHenry now and the new chairman of the subcommittee on digital assets, Congressman Hill. So they are really staking out their territory and saying, hey, we have an interest here. We want to address particularly stablecoin legislation, spot market issues. So addressing some of the key areas that do need some legislative direction.
So, Kathy, obviously we're still trying to figure out what happened at FTX, and FTX certainly says certain things. And, there's still, it feels like, more to be known because of a lack of maybe transparency. How do you see FTX? Because I'm thinking about what your firm does, right? It monitors risk for crypto assets, detecting market abuse, risks, and so on and so forth. So is your kind of company someone that could have, should have detected what went wrong with FTX potentially? Or do you see that just as bad actors?
Look, I do think that you have to have a full, risk monitoring program inside a company, compliance program. You have to have external audits, certainly appropriate governance. There were a lot of things that have been highlighted already with respect to the way FTX was overseen and the lack of controls, frankly, internal controls inside the company that an audit should have revealed. And you get to, again, fraud as to whether there were, cover-ups or two sets of books. I'm not in the weeds on, what the specifics were with respect to those things. That's why you have a bankruptcy process and certainly criminal trials and prosecution to follow, the details of what might have transpired there in great detail. So still much more to learn. But I will say, a monitoring capability like ours does address manipulation. Some of the things around perhaps what was going on with FTT, what might have been going on with insiders using information to take advantage of the information they knew that they, frankly, under most laws across the globe, would not be able to trade on or have personal gain on. So that's the kind of piece that we provide in that risk monitoring space that, it's unclear, frankly. Again, we'll know so much more over time as to what was going on inside the company, but there were larger issues of governance and internal controls, clearly.
Yeah, that's certainly been a theme. And as we've heard from John Ray and the folks who are overseeing this bankruptcy, let's talk about the future, though, and about what 2023 has in store in terms of regulation. It's kind of funny because it's like, we're talking about regulation. I chuckle a little bit because the cannabis industry has been waiting for regulation, with the Safe Banking Act for so long. I'm wondering if what we're going to see this year, Kathy. Yeah, who gets it first? I mean, are we going to see crypto regulated to a certain extent this year? Are they going to figure out which agency is going to do it?
Look, I have been a creature of this city for 22 years in Washington, and it is impossible to predict in terms of what will actually happen. And it is a long road. But we do have clearly some interest in the House side, frankly, more than the Senate. I think the Senate will end up being really an interesting situation. Can the House put enough pressure on the Senate? Is the administration interested? Does the House come up with a good bipartisan solution that people can get behind around the issues that I noted? As I said, it sounds like real interest again in tackling stablecoins to really help address what could be future financial stability issues. And then the other dynamic is what you just noted, the spot market oversight. Can we provide some clarity from Congress around whether an asset is a security or a commodity or property? Is there that opportunity?
What do you think it is?
Look, I actually think it's all of the above. People call it an asset class, and I actually am not sure that I can get behind that because I don't think it's one thing. I think it depends on which asset we're talking about and how it's being used. And so there's really been a lot of great analysis around that. I think the other challenge is that some of these projects, as the token and the project evolve, may end up morphing into something different. And that's not something that we generally see in traditional finance. You know, gold is not going to suddenly transform itself into a stock. So how we think about this overall really could use some new direction from Congress. But in lieu of that, you know, you've got regulators that are clearly, with Chair Gensler leading the way, asserting that current law applies, current regulations apply, and they're going to keep enforcing that.
Yeah.
So there are some big court cases this year.
Kathy, quick question. We know that, you know, Bloomberg did reporting that at least $73 million of political donations tied to FTX, you know, was an aspect of the story, big aspect. And I wonder how that either cooled politicians' interest in doing more here, or did it kind of fuel them wanting to do more? What was the impact of that? You're in Washington. You've been there, as you said, you're a creature of this city for 22 years. Just got about 40 seconds left here. What was the impact of kind of that coming out?
I think it cuts both ways. It depends on the member you're talking about. There's no doubt that the FTX implosion, including the political aspects of it, have left a more negative tone on the way the industry is seen. And so that's something we have to address. You hope that gets turned into positive action. And that's certainly what I would like to see, and a constructive path forward that's going to take advantage of the opportunities of blockchain technology and address the risks.
All right, going to leave it on that note. Hey, Kathy, thank you so much. Kathy, of course, is VP of Regulatory Affairs over at Solidus Labs, former director of the U.S. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. We're talking about the CFPB, which was created post-financial crisis, joining us from Washington, D.C.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, TikTok, everybody. We've got about 18 minutes left in today's trading session. Getting ready to wrap up a busy week, a busy day. And you've got stocks pretty much hovering just off their best levels of the session. But Tim, really the standout once again continues to be the NASDAQ, which has really zoomed ahead this week.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable to see what we've had just week to date, Carol, on these major indices. Look at this. The NASDAQ is up 4.8% just in the last 5 days.
Yeah, I know. And up about 12% now year to date. So it's been a big one. I'm curious to see what Tom Plum has to say.
Tom Plum is joining us from Madison, Wisconsin. He's president and chief investment officer at Plum Funds, based in Madison. The Plum Balance Fund is in the 36th percentile for the past 5 years, based on Bloomberg data, returning on average annually approximately 4%. The fund, though, year to date, a top performer, up so far more than 7%.
All right, Tom, so good to have you. Happy New Year from Tim and myself and the whole Business Week team. Okay, is this a better market, do you think, for you and your fund and your strategy?
Well, thanks for having me, Carol and Tim. It's good to see you. And it is a good New Year. You know, this is the, we just had last Sunday, we had the Chinese New Year, and so this is the year of the water rabbit, which is also called the year of hope. You know, as we know, hope's not a strategy, but probability is. And I think there's a lot of things that could bode really well for this coming year. You know, one, stock prices obviously are much lower than they were a year ago. When you had a 20-some percent decline in the S&P 500, we actually had relatively flat operating earnings. So when you look at it, the price-earnings ratio of the market is 4 points lower than it was a year ago and basically at the median of the last 20 years. Secondly, you know, you've had the commodity prices. You know, people are still very concerned about inflation, but one of the drivers was commodity prices. And, you know, the CRB in June was at 330 and now it's at 280. I think that it's going to continue
change.
To bode well for the Fed being less restrictive. And then finally, you know, the market is set up in a much stronger economic standpoint, even though we probably will have a recession. I think most people say that.
You think why do you think we'll have a recession?
Well, you know, obviously you've had the lack of money growth and the quantitative tightening and things going on with the Fed. There's a lot of reasons why people are expecting that we are going to be in a slow growth or a recession. And you know, but it looks like it's going to be relatively mild. And one of the key reasons why I think that is because of the basic liquidity in the financial system. Mm. You know, back before the great financial crisis, say J.P. Morgan, for example, had a Tier 1 capital ratio of 8.6. compared to 14.8 today.
Yeah,
banks couldn't lend to get us out of the crisis last time. This time they're still looking for good loans.
Well, wasn't it this week that Capital One got rewarded because they put more money aside, and analysts thought that that was a smart thing, that they're just kind of planning for what may come. So there is a very different environment when it comes to financials, no doubt about it. Tom, you can play or you can invest in your fund in equities, you can invest in corporates, you can go small, you can go growth, you can go value. What's the trade right now?
Well, I think you have to have a combination. Despite the fact that oil is one of the few things that are not performing today, I think energy is going to continue to be a play because with the reopening of China, the fact that it looks like it's going to be a relatively mild recession if we have one. And then finally, the strategic oil reserve, they're no longer going to be feeding in supply. So I think, you know, energy is a value play, and I think we'll hear Exxon report on Monday, and I think it'll probably be very similar to Chevron. These companies are very disciplined compared to where they were 40 years ago, and for the last 40 years, they don't just send out money because they have it anymore. They're very cautious on looking for return on capital.
Do you think that they'll announce any exploration or extracting, drilling that would make the Biden administration happy?
That's a great question, Tim, and I'm sure that they're aware of the political consequences, especially when they saw what Chevron
The White House came out with a
statement that they got from the White House.
Yeah.
But I do think that they're probably going to stay on the path that they are. They're going to emphasize their investment in North America and the Permian Basin and things like that. But my guess is they're not going to go from their current plan, which is to reinvest in a way that they feel is going to have long-term results. But it's also going to mean that they're going to continue to reward the current shareholders with buybacks and with dividend increases.
So if you had some new money to commit right now, where would you go? I mean, you look at your top holdings, Microsoft, MasterCard, Visa, Alphabet, Apple. We know some of these names, Alphabet, Apple, they're going to be reporting next week. Where would you put it?
Well, I think one of your guests earlier today was talking about the semiconductor industry. It is basically the industrials of the current world. Everything that we do touch, use, has some type of electronics or digital X to it. You know, companies like NVIDIA and AMD were last year some of the worst performers. But when you look at that performance and break it down, it really bottomed in October of last year. And you've had a real significant rebound. And NVIDIA may be ahead of itself, being up almost 40% year to date and 75% from the October lows. But you are going to have catalysts as the year progresses and as they overlap the weakness of last summer when they had the big inventory problems where, one, they started with shortages, and then they added a lot of inventory just in time to have a lot of orders canceled or rescheduled and things.
All right, we're going to leave it on that note. We always love catching up with you. Great to catch you in this new year already and look forward to our next conversation. Tom Plum, he is President and Chief Investment Officer at Plum Funds, joining us on the phone from Madison, Wisconsin. As we said, his fund, a top performer year to date, up more than 7% already. This is Bloomberg Business Week on Bloomberg Radio.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live on Bloomberg Quick Take every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.